15. As 11 o'clock came and went, Ralph was lying on the sway-backed bed in his room, knowing he should turn out the light and not doing it. He had called Jeannie and gabbed with her for almost half an hour, some of it about the case, some of it about Derek, most of it inconsequential shit. After that, he tried the TV, thinking one of Lovey Bolton's late-night preachers might work as a sleeping pill, or at least quiet the constant rat-run of his thoughts. But all he got when he turned it on was a message saying, "Our satellite is currently down. Thank you for your patience." He was reaching for the lamp when a light knock came at the door. He crossed the room, reached for the knob, thought better of it, and tried the peephole. It turned out to be useless, clogged with dirt or something. "Who is it?"
"Me," Holly said. Her voice was as small as her knock.
He opened the door. Her T-shirt was untucked, and the coat of her suit, which she had put on against the late-night chill, hung down comically on one side. Her short gray hair flew in the rising wind. She was holding her iPad. Ralph suddenly realized he was in his boxers with the buttonless fly no doubt gaping slightly. He remembered something they used to say when they were kids. "Who gave you a license to sell hot dogs?"
"I woke you up," she said.
"You didn't. Come in." She hesitated, then stepped into the room and sat in the single chair while he put on his pants. "You need to get some sleep, Holly. You look very tired."
"I am. But sometimes it seems as if the more tired I am, the harder it is to go to sleep, especially if I'm worried and anxious."
"Tried Ambien?"
"It's not recommended for people taking antidepressants."
"I see."
"I did some research. Sometimes that puts me to sleep. I started by looking up the newspaper stories concerning the tragedy Claude's mother told us about. There was a lot of coverage and a lot of background. I thought you might like to hear."
"Will it help us?"
"I think it will."
"Then I want to hear." He moved to the bed, and Holly perched on the edge of the chair, knees together.
"All right. Lovey kept talking about the Ahiga side, and she said one of the Jameson twins dropped a plastic Chief Ahiga out of his pocket." She opened her iPad. "This was taken in 1888. The sepia-toned photograph showed a noble-looking Native American man in profile. He was wearing a headdress that flowed halfway down his back. For a while, the chief lived with a small contingent of Navajos on the Tigua Reservation near El Paso, then married a Caucasian woman and moved first to Austin, where he was treated badly, and then to Marysville, where he was accepted as a member of the community after cutting his hair and professing his Christian faith. His wife had a little money, and they opened the Marysville Trading Post, which eventually became the Indian Motel and Cafe."
"Home sweet home," Ralph said, looking around at the shabby room.
"Yes. Here is Chief Ahiga in 1926, 2 years before he died. By then, he'd changed his name to Thomas Higgins." She showed him a second picture.
"Holy shit," Ralph exclaimed. "I'd say he went native, but this is more like the opposite."
It was the same noble profile, but now the cheek facing the camera was deeply scored with wrinkles, and the headdress was gone. The former Navajo chieftain was wearing rimless spectacles, a white shirt, and a tie. Holly said, "In addition to running Marysville's only successful business, it was Chief Ahiga, a.k.a. Thomas Higgins, who discovered the hole and ran the first tours. They were quite popular."
"But the cave was named for the town instead of for him," Ralph said, "which figures. He may have been a Christian and a successful businessman, but he remained a redskin to the community." Still, I guess the locals treated him better than the Christians in Austin. Got to give them some credit for that. Go on.
She showed him another picture. This one was of a wooden sign with a painted version of Chief Ahiga in his headdress and a legend beneath reading, "Best Pictographs, this way." She used her fingers to zoom out, and Ralph could see a path leading through the rocks. "The cave has the town's name," she said, "but at least the chief got something. The Ahiga entrance, much less glamorous than the Chamber of Sound, but with a direct connection to it. Ahiga's where the staff brought in supplies, and it was a way out in case of an emergency."
"That's where the rescue parties went in, hoping to find an alternate route that would take them to the kids?"
"Correct." She leaned forward, eyes shining. "The main entrance isn't just boarded up, Ralph. It's cemented over. They didn't want to lose any more kids. The Ahiga entrance, the back door, was also boarded up, but none of the articles I read said anything about it being plugged with cement."
"That doesn't mean it wasn't."
She gave her head an impatient toss. "I know, but if it wasn't,
then that's how he got in. The outsider. That's what you believe."
"We should go there first, and if there are signs of a break-in..."
"I get it," he said, "and it sounds like a plan. Good going. You're a hell of a detective, Holly."
She thanked him with her eyes lowered and in the tentative voice of a woman who doesn't know quite what to do with compliments. "You're kind to say that."
"It's not kindness. You're better than Betsy Riggins, and much better than the waste of space known as Jack Hoskins. He'll be retiring soon, and if the job was mine to give, you'd get it."
Holly shook her head, but she was smiling. "Bail jumpers, repos, and lost dogs are enough for me. I never want to be part of another murder investigation."
He stood up. "Time for you to go back to your room and get some shut-eye. If you're right about any of this, tomorrow's going to be a John Wayne day."
"In a minute. I had another reason for coming here. You better sit down."